Case number 22-5004, RK et al. Versus Bill Lee et al. Oral argument is not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Newsom, you may proceed for the appellants.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I am Jim Newsom here on behalf of defendants below, Tennessee Governor Bill Lee and Commissioner of Education Penny Schwinn. I wish to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Plaintiffs fail in their burden to show a substantial likelihood of federal jurisdiction in support of their claims against the sole defendants below, the governor and the commissioner. The preliminary injunction entered by the district court against them must be vacated. Article 3 standing requires a plaintiff to show injury in fact, traceability, and redressability. If one of those elements is missing, the plaintiff cannot invoke federal jurisdiction. In similar settings, the Fourth Circuit in McMaster and the Fifth Circuit in Paxton have recently ruled that plaintiffs asserting lack of access claims in public school settings due to lack of masking requirements failed to demonstrate redressability in respect to their claims against a governor and an attorney general. So too here. Plaintiffs' claims against the governor and the commissioner are not redressable by an injunction against them. Neither official has a specific duty to direct or prohibit a district-wide mask mandate under either Section 14.2.104A or 104D. Here, those local officials must act in order for plaintiffs' claimed injuries to arise or be cured. For the same reasons, plaintiffs alleged injuries under the Act.
How could they enforce the preliminary injunction as it stands? What could the governor do other than?
Your Honor, there is nothing that the governor can do. The discretion is with those local officials, Your Honor. The are not traceable to the governor or the commissioner for lack of a causal connection between the injury and the defendant's conduct. And as to the governor, his general duty to enforce state laws does not render him a proper defendant if, as here, the constitutionality of a state statute is challenged. Plaintiffs also run afoul of the injury in fact requirement as to Commissioner Schwinn. Any injury she might inflict against plaintiffs is wholly speculative. Plaintiffs hypothesize that if their schools were to impose universal masking in violation of 14.2.104, the commissioner would penalize their schools by withholding state funds equal to the amount of state funds dispersed in violation of the section. But this chain of events requires sheer speculation about the conduct of both plaintiffs' schools and the commissioner. For injury to occur, plaintiffs would first need to do something that they have not done since the statute was enacted in November: request universal masking from their local schools on the basis of Tennessee's new law. If the schools respond to plaintiffs' request by imposing mask mandates that violate the statute in some way, the commissioner would have to exercise her discretion in favor of withholding some amount of state funds. Due to these contingencies, Your Honors, there is no threatened enforcement action that is sufficiently imminent to satisfy Article 3's injury in fact requirement. Assuming arguendo that standing exists, plaintiffs have not established a likelihood of success on the merits due to a conflict between the Act and federal law. To succeed on their facial preemption challenge, plaintiffs must show that there is no set of circumstances that exist under which the Act would be valid. The Act does not prohibit schools from imposing masking as a reasonable accommodation. 104D, the anti-discrimination.
Can I interrupt you a moment? Can you address the district court's determination about the statutory provisions denying plaintiffs the benefit of a public education on the basis of their disabilities? In other words, impact on students with disabilities.
Your Honor, the Act at Section 104D addresses that question, because 104D is an exception to 104A. Properly interpreted, the term notwithstanding in 104D shows that 104D supersedes the Act, and as a matter of fact, the 104D specifically states that an accommodation may be granted that is pursuant to the Americans with Disabilities Act. So, Your Honor, simply put, the district court conjoined the two and conflated the two provisions in a way that was unnecessary.
Well, people with disabilities, the students with disabilities, would run into a problem if the need for masks arose, and the only way any rules would be enacted would be if the governor declares an emergency. Is that right?
That is not correct, Your Honor. As I just indicated, 104A certainly is a provision that is the public health provision of the Act, and it comes into play where severe conditions exist involving elevated rates of community spread of this particular virus, COVID-19. Your Honor, if, however, the plaintiff's request, an accommodation pursuant to 104D of the Act, we submit that the district court was incorrect in its interpretation of the statute, and that 104D will permit a local school official to take into account the request for a reasonable accommodation that is made. The court, Your Honor, must attempt to reconcile state and federal law when possible, and not seek out conflicts where none clearly exist. In the absence of a definitive interpretation from the state courts, federal courts should not assume that the state law will be construed in a way that is in conflict with federal law. And under this court's precedent in Kentucky Press, which is cited in our brief, plaintiff's claim is not ripe until the Tennessee courts, because the Tennessee courts have not yet interpreted the Tennessee Act. And indeed, plaintiffs invite this court to entangle itself in an abstract disagreement concerning the interpretation of Tennessee law.
Counsel, what is your understanding or your view of the scope of the preliminary injunction, which is on appeal?
Your Honor, the scope of the preliminary injunction on appeal is that the governor and the Commissioner of Education are restrained from enforcement of the Tennessee Act as it relates to masking restrictions in the school. Your Honor, the ADA guarantees only the right to an individualized or case-by-case decision-making based on an assessment of the needs of a disabled plaintiff or student. The ADA and 504 protect reasonable access to covered facilities and benefits by means of reasonable accommodations. The plaintiffs may prefer one accommodation to all others.
When you talk about individual decision-making, if we have a public health problem or a public health crisis, how would it be practical to make decisions on an individualized basis if this problem of transmission of disease throughout the community, the government doesn't have the resources to address that on an individualized basis, does it?
Your Honor, I see if my time has expired. May I?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. In this circumstance, the logic of the complaint is that there are disabled students who have specific medical disabilities that make them more vulnerable to infection. Certainly, the schools have the capacity to address the needs of those persons with special or particularized needs, but those need to be addressed in a particular way. A person who, for instance, has leukemia may require greater protections than one who has a mild case of asthma, but both of those are listed in plaintiff's complaint as members of their putative class, which has not been certified by the district court. I see my time has expired, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Justin Gilbert from Chattanooga, and I represent the number of students with disabilities, obviously. I'd like to begin with Judge Clay's query about the impact on students with disabilities and more pointedly address what exactly 104D means. There's a phrase in 104D that says written request, and that is if a child makes a written request
to whom?
To a principal. If a child makes a written request to a principal, then a reasonable accommodation may be given. But if you look immediately under D1 and you go down to D2, that's where we follow what happens with this written request. Specifically, under D2, if the principal approves that written request, then here's what the child gets. The child gets a moving bubble of volunteers who, quote, place themselves within that bubble of 6 feet for longer than 15 minutes. The undisputed medical proof, because we are the only side that presented medical proof, is that is not safe for our children. So it is not possible, as my friend Mr. Newsom says, that 104D provides an effective reasonable accommodation.
Mr. Gilbert.
Yes, Judge.
Is it your position that the ADA preempts this state law?
It is, Judge. My contention is...
Well, what's the problem?
The state law stands as an obstacle. We have obstacle preemption, Judge.
At the time you filed your complaint, and that was done pretty quickly after the governor signed it, had either the governor or the commissioner of education threatened to immediately, soon, enforce this law?
The law itself requires a state of emergency in order for our kids to get a reasonable accommodation. But to answer Your Honor's question,
did either one of them threaten to enforce these statutes?
There was no threat to enforce it. However, under 104A, which is the universal masking section, until the governor presses the red button of state of emergency.
Well, he's the defendant here, isn't he?
Yes, Judge.
And he didn't threaten to either declare or not declare an emergency, or certainly to enforce this act, which you say he has the ability to do. Let me ask you this. At the time you filed your complaint, had any of your clients or their parents asked for one of these accommodations of their schools under the ADA?
Yes. In fact,
now,
Okay.
Before you filed your complaint. That's what I'm asking. Not some other time in that few-hour framework. You were in a hurry to file it.
Are you talking about in the hours between the passage of the law and the filing of the complaint, Judge?
Between the signing of the act by the governor and the filing of your complaint. It's pretty quick, wasn't it?
It was very quick, and intentionally so, because all of the plaintiffs had already made their requests to the schools and were operating under mask mandates, and the result of the law prevented schools from continuing those. That is 104.
Then it overruled the ADA.
Excuse me, Judge?
It overruled the ADA then?
Effectively, it did. No longer could they get universal masking, because until the governor declared a state of emergency with these metrics that would either injure or kill our kids, they could not even interact with their local school districts. They could not even have the conversation.
Is that your position, that they could not go to the principal and ask for accommodation?
The principal could not act upon it if they did go and ask.
So they didn't ask for it in that period of time that you say they're threatened. They never said, well, you know, we want to revise our plan. We're scared about this act. They didn't do that. Is that right?
Not in those matters of hours, Judge, because they could not under the new law. The principal's hands were tied, as Judge Crenshaw found, unless the metrics were such that they would, you know, either be severely injured or killed, to use the colorful analogies, the school being on fire or the children drowning by that time. That's the only point at which they could make those requests and have them acted upon. And that's why Judge Crenshaw rightly said this is interference with the ADA. And so what you have in this act is, under 104D, is a voluntary moving bubble of masking that is ineffective. The only way to get universal masking, which will protect the kids, is through 104A. And again, the impediment is there has to be a state of emergency, which as a practical...
Let me ask you a question about masking. I don't know that it's relevant to this lawsuit, but I always thought the masking was to prevent the person that had the mask on from getting the disease. Your argument is that the mask prevents one from spreading the disease.
Yes.
Correct? Is there any?
That is correct, Judge. It goes both ways, but primarily the mask prevents the spread, because the droplets of the breath is the means of the spread.
I thought it was just the opposite.
Yeah. That's a common misunderstanding, and that's why these kids require...
Nobody accused me of being anything but common.
That's why the children need others to mask in order to protect themselves.
What do they do when they leave the school?
When they go home?
Well, when they go in the community, go with their mom and dad to the store, or do anything.
Our experts were asked that question about their own kids, and they said they would not send them to a birthday party where everyone was not masking, and they limited themselves
about
in public.
A birthday party.
They limited themselves.
Did they do then?
They would not go out. They would limit themselves from going out in public.
All these children are totally confined to home.
Certainly they're severely restricted, Your Honor. The school environment is a little bit different than being out in public, in that it is obviously compacted with children sitting in a single room for hours at a time. But yes.
But it's the droplets you claim cause the disease. Somebody passing you in a grocery store could have the droplets, right?
That's right. And that's why they would be these kids would be restricted from walking through a grocery store where people are just openly
restricted
breathing.
By whom? Their parents?
Yes, Your Honor.
nobody else?
Not the government, not that I know of, no.
Counselor, can you give me your position on the imminent threat that your clients faced at the time you filed the complaint?
Death.
What evidence is there in the record that they faced an imminent threat of the enforcement of this act by one of these two defendants at the time you filed the complaint?
TW has a single heart ventricle. SB and MS are both on feeding tubes.
About the threat from the governor or the commissioner of education of enforcing this act that would hurt that plaintiff. What evidence of imminent threat of enforcement was there at the time you filed your complaint? This is a standing problem, you know. You have to have a real...
I understand the imminent threat, Your Honor, and it is fairly traceable to the governor because the schools cannot interact with these students to get the reasonable accommodation. That is the threat. It is built into the law itself. Until the governor declares a state of emergency with these arbitrary metrics.
Had he threatened to do that? Had he threatened to do anything in the time between that he signed the act and you filed your complaint? Where is the imminent threat? That's all I want to know.
If you mean, did he say to our kids, Judge Norris, I am not going to declare an emergency until those metrics in the state statute are met. He did not say that because it's in the statute itself. And so we know that our kids cannot get the accommodation until those metrics are met. And so I don't know if you'd call that a threat by the governor or just built into the law, but that is the obstacle our kids face. They simply cannot get a reasonable accommodation. And the
you really want some friendly advice?
No, I we want... I'm sorry?
There was no threat from what you're telling me.
Well,
don't you have to go in, ask for a plan after the governor signs it, and then the school board refuses because of this statute, and then you have standing? You don't have any standing here, do you?
I don't think that's the case, Judge. If the state law were to say we no longer recognize the ADA, we don't need the governor to say I no longer recognize the ADA. It's in the statute itself. That is the threat. It's codified. And so when you look at 104A, the...
But you wouldn't have standing until one of the schools decided not to enforce under the ADA, would you?
You have standing because
under
the schools...
Your hypothetical of doing away with the ADA by the state?
Well, no, Judge. I think once it's done away with, the students cannot interact with the school districts. So the interactive process is broken by virtue of the state law.
Now, these students that previously had to wear masks because of the special student, did you say there were students that were required to wear masks?
Yes, three district courts had stricken the executive order, and thus mask mandates were in place, and the legislature passed this law after that point.
But did anybody take the mask off after that?
In Knoxville, Federal Judge Greer placed the school under a federal mask mandate and did not lift it. In Shelby County, which is Memphis, the Germantown and Collierville school districts did lift mask mandates in response to the state law. And in Middle Tennessee, which is Williamson County, they also did lift the mask mandates.
Are these, did each of those school districts have a special need child that asked for the mask as a special accommodation?
All of them asked for masking previously and thus receive were under the mask mandate previous to the passage of this law. And in fact, in our Rule 26 or 28J reply, we cite to the record as to how school districts said as a result of this passage of the new law, we will no longer enforce a mask mandate. And maybe that gets to Judge Norris's question of how do you know there was a threat? Well, the schools said so that in response
to... And you have standing against the school.
Well, we couldn't go directly against the school because that takes us right back to their hands are tied until the governor declares a state of emergency. And so it's...
You don't know that till you try.
Well, the law says so. So the,
I understand that.
Yeah, and the school said so. Both the law and the schools said in Williamson County and in the Memphis area that we will not continue with the mask mandates. And so we have both the law and the schools telling us that. Thus Judge Crenshaw said the school's hands are tied. There is no longer a mask mandate under the way, or can be no longer a mask mandate as this law is written. I see my time is almost up, Your Honors. I would respectfully request that the injunction be carried forward so that these children who are indeed at severe risk of serious illness or death can be protected in safe access to the schools. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. To follow up on Judge Norris's point, there was no threatened enforcement of the statute. The statute was passed on November the 12th, 2021, and within hours, really before the end of the day, the lawsuit was filed. There was no proof in the record of any threatened enforcement by the governor or the commissioner of education, and harm to the plaintiffs from a standing point of view was not imminent at all.
Was there any pronouncement from the governor's office or anywhere else that they would not enforce that newly passed statute?
Your Honor, there was a hearing before the district court 2 days after the lawsuit was actually the statute was passed on a Friday, and on Sunday afternoon, Judge Crenshaw entered an order stating that the status that given the alleged conflict and the possible confusion this creates for schools in Tennessee, this says, and this is in the record document number 8 in the district court, pending an expedited hearing, the parties shall maintain the status quo as it pertains to students with disabilities and federally guaranteed rights. And the court held an immediate hearing and sustained that forward. There's nothing in the record that indicated that the governor said that he was going to enforce the act in spite of the district court's immediate ruling, and there was nothing in the record that shows that the governor threatened enforcement in any way. Actually, it was really, as Judge Norris was alluding to in some of his questions, this is a matter in which the school officials, whether it be the principal of the school, the president of the school, or the LEA, the local school agency, and the school board, are the proper defendants if the plaintiffs have a claim for a denial of a reasonable accommodation under the statute. Yes, Judge Clay.
The governor did sign the statute into law, which would indicate that he was endorsing the newly passed statute. I mean, he didn't try to veto it or anything like that. He signed it and endorsed it, did he not?
Well, Your Honor, that is part of the governor's normal duties of as an executive, but that does not enmesh him into a controversy such as this, where he really has no role in terms of enforcement. For standing purposes, the question is, was there any threatened enforcement that was either made by the governor or the Commissioner of Education? And here there is no reference in the record that that occurred. So, Your Honors, there was no threat, imminent threat of enforcement by those state officials, and we simply submit that standing is lacking. If there are no further questions, defendants respectfully ask this court to vacate the district court's order and remand this action with instructions to dismiss the plaintiff's claims against the governor and the commissioner for lack of standing. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much, and the case is submitted. Clerk may call the next case.